You're listening to Reverend Jan G. Lynn speaking at Unity Temple in Oak Park, Illinois about his book, What's Wrong with the Christian Right? We're coming to you from the trenches.
Jerry Falwell said last spring that he didn't see how any Christian could be a Democrat. This past spring, with the nationwide prayer breakfast, the one in Minneapolis turned into a Republican rout, as reported in the newspaper. A judge stood up and asked for prayer for all of our political leaders, and the ones the reporter said they named, he wrote them down, were all Republicans. And the one Democratic member of the city council in Minneapolis who was at the prayer breakfast was asked by the judge, told by the judge, that he didn't think there were any Christians left in the Democrat Party. And that is the drift again. And you see that over and over again. And the partisanship is a very dangerous thing, I think, again, for politics, but also for Christianity, because it leads to another topic that I discuss, a chapter called Blind Nationalism. And that is the uncritical support of the Christian right for the policies of the United States government. And I just want to tell you one story that I begin that chapter with that sets the stage for what follows in the chapter. When I was at Lynchburg College, Dr. Eberhard Baedeker and his wife Renata spent a semester with us as scholars in residence. Dr. Baedeker was Bonhoeffer's closest friend and associate. And Renata was Diedrich Bonhoeffer's niece. Well, when they arrived in town, unbeknownst to those of us who were hosting them, they went to Thomas Road Baptist Church early. And I got into town and went that Sunday morning. Our college was just down the street from Thomas Road. And they went to Thomas Road that Sunday morning, and the ushers, not knowing who Dr. Baedeker was or Renata, when he walked in, they pinned the Jesus First pin on this lapel and an American flag on this one, which disturbed him. And later he would give lectures, and in almost every lecture he gave to students, he would bring it around and he would say, I want to speak from my own experience in Germany. And I want to tell you that whenever you put these two together, and pointing to the flag, he said, this one always wins. And we saw that in Germany, the whole confessing church movement in Germany was produced by the state church refusing to confront Hitler and the Nazi Party. And the Christian right simply gives blind support to the policies of the United States government without having that prophetic critique distancing that we believe is so essential for Christians to in our view of government. Give credit where credit is due, but not be hesitant to challenge whether a president is a Democrat or a Republican, a Green Party member, or none at all, in terms of justice, in terms of equality, and in terms of the issues that we face, war and peace. And so that is a very dangerous trend. They also practice hypocrisy. There's a whole chapter on hypocrisy. I use William Bennett as one of the examples. I love the story, and I can't read it because I can't see. But Kathy Pollitt, who writes for The Nation, does this scathing criticism of William Bennett, you know, the guru of virtues, who has a gambling problem, but selectively puts his, quote, sin outside of the problem of sin in the nation, in his opinion, because he wasn't hurting anybody but himself. And she talks about the fact that if he would cut other people a little slack, nobody would be piling on him now. But when you decide that you are the spokesperson for God when it comes to the matter of virtues, and then you have a problem yourself, then that is not, that is simply pure hypocrisy. But his friends, especially on the Christian right, said he was not guilty of hypocrisy because he never talked about gambling as a sin. So, and that's typical of the, so many, I mean, one story I tell about Pat Robinson's involvement with Smith in Liberia, and when the nuns were killed in Liberia, and his financial investment in the country. And then I want to expose them in terms of their claim that they are persecuted in this country. And I deal extensively with the book, maybe you've seen it, David Limbaugh's book, Persecution, How Liberals Are Trying to Destroy Christianity. Limbaugh, as you know, is Rush's brother. He's an attorney. And it's a huge book. And I try to address that book in this one and to critique it and show how it is really a very, very spurious in the way that he makes these claims. But the on the face of it, when we are a nation of 80 to 85% of the population in all surveys claim to be Christian. Now, we know we're not practicing Christians. In fact, there are many theologians who argue we are a nation of practical atheists. That is, we say we believe in God, but we live as if we don't. But in that kind of a nation where the Christian community is the dominant religious community in this country, for us to claim that we're being persecuted is just stretches credulity. The truth is, as I try to show in the chapter, what they really mean is that they feel persecuted when they do not get their way in the courts. And that is why they make these claims. That harkens back to an earlier chapter that I deal with, which is the chapter on Christianizing America. And the Christian right believes that this is a Christian nation. They go to great lengths to prove that over and over again. Well, this is what I argue in the chapter. The Establishment Clause of the First Amendment of the Constitution is based on the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom that was written by Thomas Jefferson and enacted into law primarily because of the work of James Madison in Virginia in 1786. And the Virginia Statute of Religious Liberty, Religious Freedom, is the basis for the Establishment Clause. And if you read that, and you can even on the internet, it's only about a page and three quarters long, page and a half, it is clear that Madison and Jefferson wanted an institutional separation of church and state for very different reasons. Jefferson wanted to protect the state from the church. Madison wanted to protect the church from the state. And they merged in their differences in the commitment to separation of church and state institutionally. So it is simply a bogus argument to say that because some of our founders were Christians, and they were, like James Madison, that they intended a Christian nation. The fact is that Madison, as a devout Christian, and Jefferson, as not a Christian but a deist, wanted the same thing. And that is no institutional tie with religious freedom, with church and state. Because they wanted religious freedom and the exercise thereof, but also for the state to be free from any of the influences of the churchliness that they had seen in Europe. And the truth is that that has proven to be wise in all of the years since then. Nowadays, what we have in their wisdom is proven beyond what they could even foresee. And that is that clearly we were a group, a nation of Christians at that time, if you had any religion at all. But today, religious pluralism proves the wisdom of the First Amendment Establishment Clause. Because the truth is that the Christian right wants to Christianize the nation. They do not, for example, believe in prayer in schools. It's not true. They don't believe in prayer in schools. They believe in Christian prayers in schools. They do not believe in religious displays on public property. They believe in Christian displays on public property, even if we appropriate the Ten Commandments as Christian. They want that. So they are not for having prayer in schools where we would have Jewish prayers, Muslim prayers, Hindu prayers, Islamic prayers, any kind of prayers. Besides the fact that that would violate the rights of those who do not want to listen to those prayers. But if you could work that out, they still would not be for it because they do not want their children hearing anything but Christian prayers. And so the idea of we want to have a theocracy, I don't think is what our founders had in mind at all. And I think the argument is simply not cogent at all in terms of Christian nation. Besides the fact that, and I don't get into this in the book, but I am an example. I'm a product of prayer in school. I grew up. I was old enough, I'm old enough that we had prayer in schools when I was. We read scripture. My fourth grade teacher that came to hear me speak on this topic in Virginia a month or so ago came up and said, "Do you remember when I made you memorize the Gospel of Luke and the birth story?" And look at me. I am an example of what the Christian right thinks is wrong with the nation. So it obviously didn't work. It doesn't work. And so it's just, it's also, what it is, those kinds of arguments about prayer in schools and public displays, it's just a flashpoint. It doesn't have any substance. You know that by the time the Supreme Court finally made the ultimate ruling about prayer in schools, that over 70% of all the schools in the Midwest, the lower Midwest, had already stopped. It didn't have any impact. But the Christian right picked up on that and said God had gotten kicked out of the schools. It was their way of having an assault on the public school system. And that's what's really going on. And it's a serious battle in places like Kansas, in places like Virginia, in places like Minnesota, where our commissioner of education, who was not confirmed by the Democrat Senate, but appointed by a Republican governor, who came from Virginia, Sherry Pearson Yeke, a month after she was not confirmed, wrote an article that appeared in the Star Tribune, which argued that separation of church and state is a myth. And she was the commissioner of education. And that is what has happened with all of this involvement with the political body politic and working in the political realm. But ultimately, the partisanship shows its and its involvement in politics shows itself Most clearly in the judicial appointments. That's where President Bush, who is the most prominent member of the Christian right in the political world, shows a proclivity for the Christian right. I document in the book that many of the people he has nominated to the federal bench are openly members of the Christian right. And the Christian right has learned what many of us have not paid attention to. And that is, if you want to change the nature of the American experience, do it through the courts. And that is what they have had a lot of success in doing. We've had recent examples of that, if you've been paying attention to some of the rulings. And it's very serious. And so that is one of the true dangers of what they are seeking to do. Well, there are some other chapters, but I try to turn more to the positive. In the chapter on wrong issues, and then what follows in that chapter, and then I'll quit and we'll do some questions, is I have what's called the Liberal Christian Manifesto. Now, some people, when I've done this talk, or one like it, they have trouble with the word manifesto. It just means declaration. And I wanted to be a little provocative. So I thought it was a good word. And some of my readers wanted to take it out. And I said, I think it's a pretty good word. And it's gotten some reaction. And that's what I've been after. But I just want to read you the Liberal Christians Manifesto for those of you who want to know what we Christians believe, who are liberal. And by the way, I use the term liberal intentionally. I think the problem with liberalism is we've let its detractors define it. And I keep saying to people, I don't hear anybody stepping back or saying, don't say that about me, or wincing when somebody calls them a conservative. It's kind of the end thing. But when you call somebody a liberal, it's like calling them a name, a dirty name, a four-letter word, you know. And I think we need to reclaim the word. It's a wonderful tradition, liberalism. So this is my shot, and I'm hoping somebody else will come up with one even better. But at least to say positive that we have an alternative to the Christian right. We don't just disagree with them. We have an alternative. So here's mine. We declare before God and humanity that as liberal Christians, we are witnesses to the gospel of Jesus Christ. You see, as a Christian, I want you to know that I am a Christian. I'm unashamedly Christian. But I'm a Christian of a different stripe. And this is what follows that defines me in a different way than the Christian right. We therefore believe that being God's people doesn't mean we are the only people of God. We believe the Bible is a moral guide rather than a book of rules. We believe in life before death as well as after. We believe the many forms of diversity among people are to be celebrated rather than feared. We believe God blesses other nations as well as America. We believe working on behalf of peace, justice, and compassion is the way of Jesus. And this one sums up all of them. We believe in telling all the truth we know without claiming to know all the truth there is. And the chapter explains what that's about. As a way of saying, especially to non-Christians, Christians are not inherently exclusivistic, narrow-minded, judgmental and supersessionist, that we supersede all other religious traditions. You do not have to believe that and be a Christian. But again, those Christians like me and others have not spoken up within our own communities enough to say that, and especially to the world. And then I make a claim that's kind of outrageous. I say in next to the last chapter that the future belongs to us. That is, liberal Christians. And the reason I say that is that I think most Americans are moderate people. And that we tolerate extremism, but we don't embrace it over the long haul. And I think the Christian right is an extremist group. And that the nation is certainly not going to embrace, ultimately, the Christian right positions. Even conservative judges, I believe, when push comes to shove, will do the right thing by the Constitution and will not rule in such a way that would create a theocracy in this nation. But within the Christian community, the question is, will they win the day within the Christian community? I don't think they will. I think, again, liberal Christians represent the way into the future, because Christianity is going to have to deal with religious pluralism, whether we like it or not. And we cannot make the claims that we have made throughout the centuries since Constantine and the whole Christendom movement that we have made before. We simply cannot sustain that. And what we've got to learn to do is to say, this is who we are and this is the truth we know. But God is bigger than anything anybody believes. God is bigger than any theology. And so we cannot encompass God. We are thankful as Christians that we're just included in the family of God and rejoice and celebrate that. And Jesus, I think, if we read the Gospels in a different way, actually affirms that rather than speaks against it. The last chapter, if you're interested, is a call to dialogue. I just think Christian writers need to quit calling people names, quit judging them, and let's have some discussion about the real differences that separate us, because they are serious. Because the issues we face in this world we live in are very serious issues. And we need to have some discussion. I don't think that the future of the nation depends on the marriage amendment. But I think that's a serious issue we need to discuss. Are we willing to change the Constitution for what seems clearly to be a politically motivated notion of protecting marriage, when 75% of all marriages in this country are between people who have already been living together and have had children, many of them? The idea that homosexual marriage is threatening the institution of marriage is a little bit suspicious. But the question is serious in terms of what kind of nation we're going to be if we do those kinds of things, especially in the States. And so I think we need to have dialogue and discussion in a civil way with each other, and I invite them to do that.
That was Reverend Jan G. Lin, author of What's Wrong with the Christian Right, speaking at Unity Temple in Oak Park, Illinois. After his talk, Reverend Lin responded to questions from the audience, including this one about the Christian right.
They have felt disenfranchised and up until the last 15 years, really since 1980. 1980 is when the shift started, and we were never sure whether Reagan was using Falwell or Falwell was using Reagan. But that's clearly when the Christian right began to get embedded in the body politic. Jerry Falwell moved in and out of Washington. He was at Reagan's inauguration in 80 and 84. He was a prominent factor in the Republican Party, and of course Pat Robertson ran for president on the Republican Party, or at least ran for the nomination. And so it's been going on now almost 25 years. But before that, they felt disenfranchised. They were threatened by the kind of sexual revolution and the challenge to authority that came out of Vietnam and the civil rights movement, and never saw the benefits of the challenge to that authority, saw it as an erosion to church authority. Because when other institutions are challenged at the point of their authority, then the churches get very shaken by that because of church authority. And you question any institution, then the church is next. So I think that's correct. And there is no doubt that we have not recovered from the 4th century and when Constantine became a Christian. And then Theodosius I made being a Christian a necessity for survival in the empire. Then there are many scholars that have made very detailed studies of how that inalterably affected Christianity, and we've never recovered. A guy named Lee Camp just wrote a book called Mere Discipleship, and he argues that Christians wear what he calls a Constantinian cataract. And he says we've worn it for so long that we don't even know we have it on. And we see the world through the eyes of the merger of empire and church. And that is certainly what the Christian right is doing. The problem is they don't study history. They really do not study history and take it seriously and the lessons. And so that's why I'm concerned about the blind nationalism that they demonstrate, because it's an example of Constantinian Christianity. And the Crusades were a product of the blending of church and state under Constantine. And again, some of the most atrocious things happened in the Middle Ages. I mean, laws in Europe that Jewish children had to be taken away from Jewish parents to save them from their infidel parents, and they were placed in Christian homes. This was part of some of the laws in Europe in the Middle Ages. It's just unbelievable. And there's a catalog of those. One of my former professors, Clark Williamson, a theologian, has written extensively about those kinds of practices. So, yes, the Christian right is a modern extension of that. The question is whether we in this country will repeat the mistake of Europe or see the dangers before it's too late. I'm confident we will see the dangers, but I think we've got to start paying attention. But power and fear. I've often said that many Christians try to scare the hell out of people to get them into heaven. And I really think that's the way it is. But fear is a strong motivator. And of course you hear it in the rhetoric. I mean, the Christian right will say, essentially, if we don't pass this marriage amendment, the institution of marriage will be doomed, without anybody examining whether or not that really has any credibility to it. And it's just amazing how often people accept things without challenging. And I think one of the lessons that we can learn from is Nazi Germany.
You've been listening to Reverend Jan G. Lynn, author of What's Wrong with the Christian Right, speaking at Unity Temple in Oak Park, Illinois. From the Trenches is produced by the Chicago Independent Media Center with help from Loyola University. You can post your own stories, listen to this program again, or find out about news and information from around the world through our internet address. The address is www.chicago.indymedia.org. Many thanks to WLUW for their continued support. Listen again on the fourth Monday in January at our new time, 10 a.m., for another report from the Trenches.